Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Moors. Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tohaka Amana El Bay. And tonight's broadcast is Moorish Consolidation of Power. And what we're going to do is explain from every conceivable angle how we're going to get that done. Keep in mind that on the 12th and 13th of this month, right there at 1625 North Pearl Street at Masjid El Salam's bookstore, we will be hosting the Moorish Summit, the Summit of the Moors. And this is in tribute to that. We got quite a few guests that's going to be here this evening. We're going to have Brother Kamitiu Bey is going to be here, Sharif Noble, Jermaine Shannon L., Diallo Sakur, Sundiata Amana L., and there'll be many others. I'm looking at the switchboard. The brothers are coming on in, and that's fantastic. I want to say we have created one of the most comprehensive libraries in the United States, and what you're going to hear tonight comes directly from out of these archives. So we pay very close attention to what you hear this evening, and I will be posting information and access information into the chat. And I'm also going to ask the brothers to give their input on a lot of information that we're going to be dealing with this evening. So you all hold your hat. We're going to go directly in this thing. And after I'm done with this one plug, we're going to start opening up the line so the brothers can come on in, okay?
I'm doing the civil rights movement. Let me show you what you lost. The number of people coming into the country, just black folk during that time, were struggling for voters' rights. They were being shot, lynched, whipped, and beaten, and bombed all through the South just for the right to go to the polls and vote. You just lost your voting power in this country. The immigrants wiped out your voting power. Your whole civil rights movement was a waste of time now, and those deaths were useless, futile. When in 1970, we outnumbered Hispanics, as an example, 2-1. They have now caught you and passed you. I predicted that in my first book, Black Labor, White Wealth. They'll catch you in the year 2000. They caught you exactly in the year 2000, right on the money. They now got 42 million in the country. You got 36 million. They can now outvote you on anything they want and block you on anything you want in the country. Now we got 14 to 20 million immigrants floating around this country, undocumented illegals, that the Congress is planning on giving amnesty to because white corporations want the cheap labor. Black folk are an obsolete labor class. They want some new labor. And so what they're going to do now is give them amnesty to 14 to 20 million. You add that 14 to 20 million to the 42 million you already got. That takes them up to almost 60 million Hispanics then in the country. Now, based on the 1986 immigration law, they then got a right to bring in their spouses, their children, and their parents. And we estimate that that'll bring in another 35 million Hispanics. They will then have 90 million to your 36. They would outnumber you 3-1 within 10 years. If you couldn't outvote whites, you haven't got a snowball's chance of outvoting Hispanics alone. Your vote was neutralized a long time ago. When I was running political campaigns for president back in 84 and for Carter in 76, and I ran in Atlanta, Georgia in 88, and again for Clinton's deputy political strategy in 92, I knew then that the black vote was gone and dead. See, whites alone outnumber you 8-1. That means 8 will go over 1 at least 8 times with nothing left over. Your vote is only important in the power economics principle when you vote as a majority. You must be the majority population. You cannot integrate and get economic power. You cannot integrate and get voting power. You must always try to figure out how to come together and aggregate to get your power. If you don't come together and become the majority population, your vote means nothing. If I throw a rabbit into a pen with 800 bulldogs, the rabbit can vote all he wants about what they're going to have for dinner. And now, so that's why I tell the black folk, we now have to learn how to use powernomics principles. Now, how does that relate to your marketing? Here's the problem. You're now competing with these other groups that are coming to the country. They're doing what you're not doing. They're coming in here to build communities. We do not have not one single black community in America. We do not have one defined black market in America. If you don't have a defined black market in America, it makes it very difficult for you to compete against those groups. See, those groups, and not only do you find across America, when they come into this country, they'll build a Japan town, a Chinatown, a little Korea, a little Saigon, a little Cambodia. You go across America and find little Havanas, little Hialeahs, little Italy. You find Greek towns, Pole towns, Chinatowns, but you never find a black town. And so if you're working for a white corporation, how are you going to serve the white corporation? What are you going to do? Go out. You're going to go out and try to find black folk and sell them products that weren't even produced by you, that are produced by other people. So what you got to do then is got to figure out how to, most of you got to figure out how to get out of some of those jobs and quit being job seekers and be job producers, point one. You got to learn how to produce jobs. You produce those jobs by going out and at this point in time to save yourselves and survive, you got to go out and start rebuilding communities. You cannot get power and wealth unless you have communities. Everybody in America have communities except us. We do not have one single solitary black community in America. All we got are black neighborhoods. A black neighborhood is like a bucket with a hole in it. It won't hold anything. You can pour water in all you want to. A community, to be a community, you must have three elements in it to have a community. You must have a wholly independent economic structure with people in there who are producing goods, services, and jobs and business opportunities for their own people. Two, you must have a code of conduct that teaches you how to support and buy from those people who you live with and look like you. And three, you must have some governance or some organization that will speak for you in politics. We don't have any of that. Every organization we got speaks for everybody. You go out and look at the book, you'll find Asian organizations, Jewish organizations, Korean organizations, Chinese organizations, but you won't find any black organizations. You'll find the Urban League. What's that? We don't know who that is. And when you get the black organization, they won't fight for black rights. See, if I go out in the marketplace, and women will come in. Women will fight for women's rights. Gays fight for gay rights. Hispanics fight for Hispanic rights. Asians fight for Asian rights. Veterans fight for veteran rights. Senior citizens fight for senior citizen rights. You get the black folk, who they fight for? They fight for civil rights. And I ask, who is civil? Where does he live? And see, even I want to send him somebody, I wouldn't even know where to send it. Because we don't fight for anything for our own people. But once you build these communities, you got to go inside there, and that's your market. Your market must be your communities. And if you start building these communities, then it makes it very easy for you all to promote your products if you've got an identifiable community someplace to go into. And that's why the others are beating you. See, because they not only do they build their communities, but they put up ethnic barriers to make sure you cannot penetrate their communities, that you cannot market into their communities. They build their communities, and they close them against you. So a black person working for a white corporation trying to market a product, they're not going to let you in their communities. Right now, the Chinese have a culture code which says this. First of all, that we would never, ever hire a black person in one of our business under any circumstance. We'll never hire you. And two, we'll never buy products from you. And they'll tell you that straight up. We will not buy from you. And so in our organizations, what we do, we got a Taiwanese we send into the Chinese stores. Because he tells you straight up, no, our people, the Chinese will pretend they can't speak English. When you go in to deal with them. And when you go into Chinatown, they mark their communities. And they put up, and these barriers make them competitive. All of them live together, except us. We are scattered. If you're scattered, you have no market. Nobody's going to drive all over town trying to find where your store is. So right now, Detroit, when I get into the good news now, in Detroit, Michigan, we're trying to rebuild our first big national community in America. In the city of Detroit, we have an area, a project area. My project area is over 100 acres. I got another 141 acres outside the city. We're going to build, I'm putting in 21 to 26 factories in there. I'm putting in about 15 distributorships. And I'm putting in about 50, almost 50 to 52 businesses in there where black folk can now walk to work and walk and shop. And now when you all come, and now you marketers can come because you got your own community to come to sell your product. So when your corporations say, well, I don't know where your consumers are, where the black consumers are, where they are, you say, yes, I know where they are. We got one area in Detroit. We're going to build them in other cities, just like you got an Asian town or Chinatown. And see, when you build these communities, you put up barriers too. Like in Chicago, where is Deborah? Like in Chicago, see my good friend Dorothy Tillman. See, Dorothy Tillman's been using those power economics principles down on 47th and South Martin Luther King Boulevard. You know what I'm saying? Okay, so what I told Dorothy, after you go in there and you find me a black area in Chicago and start building black businesses in there and tell the rest of them, if it's not your community, so long, adios, goodbye. And bring in black businesses and put them in there. And she's been doing that. Am I right, Deborah? Okay. And you do that. And then I told her, she said, what else did I do? I said, once you build these communities so that your marketers and developers can get in, you mark and close your community just like the others do. When I go into Chinatown, as soon as I come around the corner, I'll see a big pagoda. And I'll see all kind of flags. And I'll hear ting dong, ding dong. I know they mark that community. That's theirs. And they're going to speak. They're going to use their language to go look at the street signs. They're going to change those street signs. So it reflects their culture. So it's closed, so you can't speak the language. You can't get in and get out. You got to learn. So I endorse what Dorothy Tillman does, and you go down there, Deborah. See, you look up on those telephone posts. Am I right? Thank you. See, and you see those big silhouettes, gold silhouettes of a silhouette of a black man with either a saxophone or a trumpet. Am I right, baby? And that you do the same. You build your communities and close them. So that you got a market to promote your products in. And not only, but now you got a closed community. And when you put up those barriers, that gives you a competitive advantage, just like the Asians got a competitive advantage in Chinatown, and the Hispanics got a competitive advantage, like in Miami. So you go into Miami, when the Cubans came into Miami, when I'm over education down there, the Cubans went in and took over all the distributorships, all in South Florida, so they control the industries down there, and they use their culture and their language as a barrier, so no one else can get in. When I go down there.
Okay, brothers and sisters, that was just the first plug that I want to run for you this evening. I'm going to open up the line and let my guest in. Area code 347, tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment.
Yes, Islam wants to come to you.
Okay, hold on, brother. Let me open up line number two. Area code 706, come on in.
Peace, Dalo Sekou.
Peace, brother. Area code 516. 516, come on in.
Yes, sir. Jason Sarai is here.
Okay, peace, brother.
Peace.
Area code 561, come on in.
Peace. This is Brother Sundi out of IMAL.
All right, fantastic. Wow. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I don't even think I got no more room on the switchboard because this is dropping all the way down to the floor. This is a very, very important issue that we have on the table. And ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who are new and listen to this broadcast for the very first time, we're about to have the Summit of the Moors that will be held here in Jacksonville, Florida, the 12th and 13th of this month. And the brothers that are on here this evening and whose lines I just opened up, they will be dropping heavy information there so that we can put this thing together and actually make it a reality in America. We're going to be hosting workshops. and this is just not something where you come in and hear a good speech and go away with. No, we're actually finna do some things here up in this city, and we want this thing to spread all across the United States. We're going to set up an economic base and go ahead and take the bull by the horns and do this thing. Before I begin to communicate with my guests, I want to say that I am offering the free articles as usual, the 14th Amendment Exposed, Commerce Game, How to Play, the History of the United States and its Commerce, and the way you access that is simply by contacting me by email at tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll get that to you. All of the plugs that you hear this evening in between communication with my guests comes directly from out of my archives. And the way you access that is by contacting me, Tahaka, at area code 904-303-9061. And please contact me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have a few more guests that are going to be coming in, but we're gonna go ahead with what we got right now. Brother, commit to you, Bay. What's going on, man?
Nothing much, Ma. We're just analyzing the language that the brother is putting out. You know?
Like,
and,
it's like a radio broadcast. So,
somebody
have
need to get their phone.
Brothers, I got all y'all lines open at the same time, so if we can control that background noise, we
all
can
right.
have a conversation between all of us right here. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, go ahead, brother. Commit to you, Bay.
Yes, like I was saying, well, I commend you for the work that you're doing, Brother Tahaka. That was an excellent piece that you put out there, because that piece you put out there is definitely a think tank and a food for thought, because as the brother had put out there about the word community, he gave three elements and methods to a community. I also put my etymology signs to that word community too, because when you see the word community, you see the word commerce in there, and then you see the word unity. So we don't have commercial unity among ourselves, all right, as a people, you know what I'm saying? And so that's one reason why we're suffering. And another thing, too, that the brother had pointed out was the fact that because of the Chinese or whoever foreign entity that comes in and to do business, language is always a key, because, as he stated, that they have a language barrier around their trade. So, therefore, you won't even know how to understand how they operate to do business because there's a language barrier. All right, and so, you know, he brought out a lot of excellent factors there, Noble. You know, a lot of excellent factors. You know, he definitely had my thoughts popping, you know, with all kinds of legal terms that one can go to the Black Law Dictionary and look at, like gerrymandering is one, you know what I'm saying? Because not only that is the votes are being divided up politically, but also, before we can even say that the votes is divided up politically, but we got to look at the three-fifths of a person, because I always say, and I always put that out there, that when our people do go to the polls, unfortunately, they have no knowledge that how do your vote count? Is it counting three-fifths of a person, or are you getting the whole person is being counted, the number of whole persons? This is the language that's being used in Article 1, you know what I'm saying, of U.S. Constitution. So we never address the issues concerning how our people is being involved. But then again, if we're not nationals like we're supposed to, then how are we going to acknowledge that free national vote as the Prophet Noble Juwali has put out there, Brother Doc?
Okay, that is definitely something that we have to look at. And but before I go to man number two, y'all hold your hat. One second.
Islam, Hotel, Barigani. What's happening in peace? January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, we will have Summit of the Moors. This is a collective effort to bring about economic security that is a great opportunity for our people to forecast their own future, beginning with a collective approach that can benefit all. The educators, the speakers are all diverse to represent the people who are also diverse in their ideologies. On deck we have Kadara Bey, Dr. Aileen Bey, Julani Bey, Tahaka Amina L. Bey, Abundance Child, Sundiata L., Daraya Bey, the Federation of Southern Cooperative, German Shannon L., Sharif Noble, and myself, Asar Dalo Sekou Aberel. Topics will be food security, such things as aquaponics, gold and silver purchasing, technology, cooperative application, the administrative process, and lots more. We also have what's called private side sessions. These sessions will not be recorded, any recording, audio or visual, for the public. You have to be in person in order to get these jewels. And we also have some special guests who didn't want to be advertised that will come and drop more information. I'm urging everyone to go to www.dalosekou.com and register. This is free. This is a free event. It is www.dalosekou.com. DialoSekou.com. January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, Summit of the Moors. Peace.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Now, I'm going to call on the man now who you just heard on that plug right there. Brother Diallo, come on in.
Yes, sir. How y'all doing this evening?
All right. Tell me about Claude, man. Tell me about what Claude said.
Say it again, what Claude said?
Yeah, man.
Well, what Dr. Claude Anderson was talking about, exactly some of the principles I'll be introducing at the summit. And it's very clear, one thing we have to do is that we're spread. And it's when we're spread around, we don't have any real power. There's a saying I said at this thing I did in Delaware a few years ago. Family creates the necessity for inherent natural liberties that guarantee a sound existence. Meaning we have to have an industry. We have to have the primary things, food, clothing, shelter. And we have to have security. And in order to initiate this power outside of our own individual homes, we have to bring these homes closer together. And outside of those homes, we have to have an industry or business of owning and controlling whatever it is that we're going to do, so we can have some equitable interest inside the businesses and controlling and being able to create wealth. And from that, what Dr. Claude Anderson was talking about is the things that when you mention how the Jewish, I've been asking Moore's all week, yo, if I ask you in your city, where's the Jewish community, they can literally go there, point to it, or talk about it. But if I said the black community, they'll say it's side of town, but it's a difference between a community and a neighborhood. The Jewish community is definitely outlined. The Chinatown is definitely outlined in New York City, Texas, Japantown out in California. These things are defined. It's a defined area when you go into it, who's running it, who controls it, who's owning it. If you go to Chinatown, there's not a black-owned store in it. But if you go to the so-called black neighborhood, you got the Chinese food restaurant, you got the Chinese landlord owners or the Jewish land. Everybody's in there because we are victims of our own lack of information and lack of ownership. So when you don't have a defined closed-off area, anybody can come in. If your leaders aren't protecting or defining what it is that we're supposed to be doing as a people, then you become victims to everybody else. Everybody else can come in and take advantage and exploit what we're doing and what we don't know or what we like of. You know, like a plumber charging you $50 just to come out, not even to start the work, but to come out because you're not a plumber. You're not certified in that. You don't know. So we have to get certified and know certain things so that we can close the wagon circle off and secure our future for our children. And the principle is basically like this. If you have that one community, that community needs a voice. It needs security on the land, and whether it be to influence the politicians or to secure anything else outside of on land, you have to have a voice. And so something I introduce is a group. Like, for example, you have the Jewish Defamation League. You know that they're talking about the Jews. They aren't talking about Moors. They aren't talking about Italians. They are to protect the rights of the Jews. So this group that I'm talking about needs to be able to protect, not only just protect, but to initiate certain things outside of this one particular community, but even the unconscious Moors as well, you know, which will help push us out further. We need to be the one leading these movements as activists, and not just online and one person per thing, but as a group, as a whole body. So with that group that comes out of that community and that group should be duplicated. But we have to make moves. We have to share resources. We have to share information so that we can get on the same page.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. Well, you I'm in 100% agreement with you. And we're going to deal with this here tonight. Brother Sundiata, come on in here, man. Let us have it. Tell us about it, man. Show me what you're working with.
peace to the Moors. peace to the Nobles.
Peace.
Yeah, definitely everything backing up 100% what Brother Diallo Sekou just went over in terms of what Brother Claude Anderson was talking about in that first club. I would encourage everybody to pick up some of Claude Anderson's work. The first book that he mentioned was Black Labor, White Wealth. That was the first book that I actually read of Claude Anderson, and it completely put the relationship of man with himself and man with his own ethnic group in relation to other ethnic groups into perspective. It really puts you in a different mind state to kind of open you up to how economics works. Not the economics that they teach you in school when you finish out of high school, you go to college. It ain't that economics. He breaks it down and makes it plain for you so that you understand that if you're not working as a collective, then there's just no single way that you and your people are really going to be able to ascend to a higher level in terms of, you know, status, in terms of collective wealth that you can pass on to the next generation, that generational wealth. So I agree with everything Brother Diallo said, and even the follow-up book that Brother Claude Anderson did called Powernomics, that book is so detailed in terms of what we could actually do, the steps that we could actually take to ensure that generational wealth, to ensure the accumulation of that wealth, to be able to pass on to the next generation, to be able to start businesses that we can pass on to our youth and say, hey, when your father, when your mother, when your uncle, or your auntie is done holding on to this business or done putting their time and energy into it, you take it over. And what I've been able to see in my time here on this earth, a lot of black businesses, so-called black businesses, have struggled so badly and have force their children to work within that business that when the children become of age, they no longer want to even carry on that legacy that their parents created for themselves or that their grandparents created. So they end up just walking away from the business, selling it off, and going on just to work for somebody because it's easier to work for somebody. At least that's the perspective of the slave mind. It's easier to just be a slave than to be your own creator and to be your own master of your destiny. So some of the things that I want to touch on specifically in regards to this collectivism and in regards to Powernomics is the food issue. We know that our babies out there are having a very hard time feeding themselves. A lot of them can't feed themselves. They're not in a position to feed themselves. So their parents are having to stoop to all kind of decadent means and ways to try to feed themselves and their children. But there's just so many other ways and so many other formulas that we can implement to ensure that our children are fed, to ensure that other adults are able and capable to create food systems to feed themselves and their children and as well as communities as a whole. Being in the Tallahassee area, for sure, I've been able to witness a food movement that has taken the city by storm. And this is the type of movement that we can duplicate anywhere we go, not just in these United States, but we can go anywhere in the world and duplicate this type of food system where it's based on collectivism, it's based on community, it's based on the love that you have for your brother and you have for your sister. So I want to bring that issue of food security to the table.
Okay.
Now, this is something that, I'm sorry, you want to say something, Brother Parker?
No, I was just saying, okay, I wanted to get everybody's thoughts.
Yes, sir.
What we're going to do here this evening, we definitely going to deal with that. Ain't no doubt about it, because, see, without that, we ain't going nowhere. We had to get the groceries right first. Now, I got one more man. One more man. We got four lights lit up. I got one more man. Come on in, man. Right. Let me know what you think about it.
Who are you speaking to?
I'm speaking to the last man. You know who I'm talking to.
Need to call his name out so you know.
Huh?
They need to call his name out so you know.
Okay. I'm going to have to go back to that because I'm going to slip one. Hold on a second. Hold on. Area code 904. Come on in.
This is Dr. Van Buren Lewis Bay, Middleburg, Florida Territory.
All right. What do you think about what you heard, brother? Let us have it.
Oh, man. It's just incredible to hear the unity in the voices of these brothers. And I think that included among all of ourselves as the Moors now, those others that are coming in have some tremendous programs in place where we could all bring this unity together and create a complete new economic system and a new economic thought. And I think that is we'll discuss it at the conference, and I'll present more detail. I'm in full agreement with everything that we've heard from Brother Diallo and all of the brothers that have spoken up to this point.
Okay.
We look forward to seeing everybody at the conference.
All right. Fantastic.
Can I say something real quick, Doc?
Yeah, go ahead, brother.
For people listening, they need to know that there's a phase two in August. August the 17th, we'll be right back in. Put it like this, there are four phases for the public, okay? Phase two is August the 17th, which is Marcus Garvey weekend. I'm sorry, birthday. We'll be right back here with the phase two of the summer. There's going to be four phases. It's laid out so that we can, we're going to be implementing the second day is Sunday. Monday, we should be implementing whatever we agreed upon this weekend. Come to work, bring your laptops. You'll have a package once you get here, but bring your laptops. If you have information, bring it. Bring it to empty jump drives or whatever you have. We're going to share. We're going to put stuff on the table, and we're going to eat.
All right.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Excuse
now,
me. Can I say something?
Yeah. Who am I talking to?
This is Jason Sarias. You invited me on Facebook.
Yeah. Come on.
Basically, I just wanted to add in, I love what I'm hearing as well. I might as well just throw a little info. 25, resides in Long Island, New York. And I just wanted to add that I noticed you said that you touched on collectivism, and I think that that's an important philosophy to understand. However, I just wanted to add in that, see, I've been following a lot of what you guys have been saying, even on Facebook. I know you guys probably don't even know, but I'm always watching different posts, and I was in a lot of the different groups that they have, like African militant revolutionaries, and I'm even in the Black Atheist group as an atheist. But anyway, I just wanted to just put out there that I think individualism needs to be touched on too, because I noticed you guys were saying how, you know, you need leaders. We need leaders that can bring the community together. But the problem is, just like most of the religious groups, what happens is...
Hey, let me stop you there. Let me stop you there. Nobody said we need leaders to bring the group together, but go ahead.
Well, all right, maybe I misheard something, but what I was going to say is that I personally feel like unless you instill the idea of individualism into people first, then you can't really get them to excel in any other philosophies, because to be a part of a group, you have to understand your own individual place in the group first before you can really help tackle. And I think what happened to the Black community, and I agree with, like, everything I heard. But I think what happened with the Black community especially is that once the group fell, once our group collectivism fell in the slavery time, what also happened was we lost connection with the ability to find ourselves as individuals because we lost the confidence in the social structure. So I just wanted to just throw that out there.
All right. Okay,
before we go on,
I'd like to address that.
Hold on, brother. Before we go on, let's look at this from one more different angle, and then we're going to come right back, and then we can dig into this thing. So just hold on.
They can't raise anything. They can't raise their crops. If they raise them, they don't have a distribution system. They don't have a market because they don't have a community. Nobody can get the crops from Tuskegee, from the South, to New York City because, see, the white won't let you use their system to do it unless they control it, manipulate, and they get the profit and advantage. So those poor farmers down there are losing their land at twice or three times the rate of white farmers. In 1920, we had 20 billion acres of land, 20 million acres of farmland in this America, in the United States belonged to blacks. It's down to less than about 400,000 acres now. You're going out of existence. And as the food crop moves further and further away from black folk into the hands of two or three major corporations, you're in serious trouble. Because 78% of all the blacks in America now live in 10 large cities. You got a 10-day food supply. If somebody wanted to, they can starve all the blacks in America to death in less than 2 weeks. Your farm, you're losing your farmlands and everything else. Nobody want to make an issue out of it. Washington Post had the front pages saying the black farmers are almost gone. But anyhow, so what happened then after the Civil War? The immigrants came in, bumped blacks out, froze them out. Some people say, well, black folk can compete if we educate them. Wrong. Didn't work. When black folk came out of slavery in 1866, they had a 98% illiteracy rate. That means only 2% of the blacks in the United States could read and write in 1860. But by 1900, blacks reduced their illiteracy rate from 98% down to 40. Blacks learned faster than all those white immigrants that came into America. Blacks cut their illiteracy rate faster than all the European immigrants. But when I went back and did analysis on job mobility and on money and wealth, guess what happened? The whites that came in, they went up, blacks went down. Which means education was not the factor. So you tell a child to get an education, and you don't deal with racism, it won't do any good. And I got blacks all over the country telling me, so Dr. Anson, it's time for black folks to put racism behind them. Black people cannot put racism behind you because you didn't put it in front of yourselves. You don't have the power to put anything behind you. And the most dangerous thing you can do is to start talking about cutting yourself away from your history and the fact of racism. Because let me tell you all why. And remember this. There's only three ways we could have possibly gotten into our dilemma. Either we were where we are because God wished it up here, or because we are genetically inferior down here, or because somebody's been playing games in social engineering. One of those three. Now, I don't believe God wished black folk to be in this dilemma. But yet, the dominant white society taught that and used their churches from 1600 up until 1860 to say that God wished it. The blacks somehow were smited, being an offshoot of Ham. Remember that? They used the Bible to teach that black folk were inferior and that you were justifiably slaves. Then from 1860s up until present day, they've been using genetics. That's why you got a book all called The Bell Curve, saying that you're genetically inferior. That's why you're in your dilemma. And what I tell blacks over, both of those are tales. You're where you are because you've been socially engineered. The last thing. People have been playing games with you, manipulating the circumstances, controlling you. And if somebody has socially engineered you into your dilemma, the only way you're going to get out is for somebody to take the responsibility of what? Socially engineering you out. And that's why I created the Harvest Institute. And so what we're doing now is trying to go back and understand everything that's happened to black folk, and I'm trying my best in my books, in my institute, to turn everything upside down and give you a halfway fighting chance to come out of it as a winner. I don't want you to lose anymore. I'm tired of black folk losing. Okay? So let me finish up with a little bit of history and we'll get into the solutions, because I only got about 38 minutes left. Now, here's what happened. So by 1900, when Jews began to come into the country, what they were doing then, they came in looking for wealth building opportunities. Go look at all their basic documents for their organizations. They came in looking to build businesses and to find wealth and money. When our organization came in, the Urban League and NAACP, between 1905 and 1912, what they looked for black folk was going back to that old public policy that was set up in 1660 saying black folks should be a labor, subordinated, non-compensated labor class. So what they were looking for us was to do what? Find what? Jobs. Which means you were to be employees. Never employers, but to be employees. And so immediately after the First World War, blacks started getting a little uppity when they came back from World War I. And the whites in the South didn't like that. And so you had major conflicts. And the whites, so racism intensified in the country. Blacks had farms. Some of the white radical groups started burning their crops. They started lynching on an average of 2 to 3 blacks a day. And they poured kerosene on their cotton and ran blacks out of the South. Those blacks then by 1920 were moving north. They moved into Gary, Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, New York, and went into the factories. And when they started moving out, whites then started working on trying to get a replacement for them. Because at that point in time, black folk were picking on average about 20 pounds of cotton an hour. So whites started inventing a machine. And by 1940, blacks had invented a machine called a cotton picking machine that can now pick 1,000 pounds of cotton an hour. So by 1947, black folk were obsolete in the South. They no longer needed you in the South. You were through in the South by 1947, machine that replaced you. But all those blacks who drifted north in those big cities had gone into the steel mills, automobile plants, chemical plants, meatpacking plants, and were doing reasonably well. Blacks did reasonably well in the north between about 1940 and 1966 in those factories. Then all of a sudden in about 1966, guess what happened again? Technology caught up, and black folk went obsolete in the north. And ironically, blacks went obsolete in 1966, right in the midst of the civil rights movement. When Martin Luther King was saying, free at last, thank God we're free at last, he was not talking about black folk. He was talking about, for the first time in history, whites no longer needed black folk. And whites were free. They now had invented a computer and computer-driven machinery, they no longer needed you. So the factories started closing down in the north at that point in time. And that's when your crime started going up too. Because not only they started closing down and firing blacks in those major cities, but at that point in time, the public policy on black folks shifted to what it is today. Now the old public policy, remember, was that black folk were being excluded, subordinated, non-compensated, non-competitive, managed workforce for the personal confidence and wealth building of white society. They shifted it to where it is today.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, brothers, I need you to hold on and open up one more line. Here it goes, 706. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment.
This is Carlos, who I hung up, and I had to get back online.
Okay, well, you hold right
but
there.
Since you got
okay,
me,
now,
but since you got me open, brother, let me say this real quick. The brother
okay.
mentioned something about the black communities. That's the issue. We're not dealing with what's the so-called black community. This is we're not dealing with colorful titles. We're gonna deal with the real deal, the nationalities or more.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I want to make that clear.
Okay. Well, fellas, this is what we're gonna do. Now, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We got 5 lines open, and what I'm gonna ask you to do is be respectable. For each other's time to communicate. Now I'm gonna start with brother commit to you, and we're going straight down the line. Now I'll ask you to be brief, and then the next man come on in, and so go ahead, brother, until we get to the whole thing. Go ahead, brother.
Islam family. You know, just listening to Clark Anderson and it's an expert think tank. That this brother is putting out at the forum, you know, and that's something that white brothers and sisters definitely need to look at. He brought some issues out that I and another more are working on right now, the black farmers. We're going to be working on that. Of course, you may be aware of the fact that the black farmers, all right, lack of a better word, it's not a term that Morse used, but unfortunately, that's the references that we use, something like Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey didn't want to call them Negroes, but, of course, unfortunately, that's what they stuck to, that's what the prophet talked about, you know, that we stuck to these undesirable names. But in the meantime, the Black Farmers Association had won a couple of billions of dollars to suit, and their monies have not been liquidated. And my attitude, brother, is for this time being, so to be clear, that because unfortunately we're not clothing ourselves, we're not housing ourselves, we don't have any forms of health care, we can't give each other no jobs. But one thing I can say that we definitely need to do, and that's very clear and cut, is we definitely got to feed ourselves. If we can feed ourselves, we'd be all right. You know, we may not be dressing ourselves like we're supposed to, by having industries as far as textiles or clothing and fabric and stuff like we should be having. We're not having housing that we should be having, or any other industry that we need to have to sustain ourselves. But one thing that we definitely need is to feed ourselves. If we can really do that, that would be one of our biggest survivors, to feed ourselves. Because listening to what that brother said, it's exactly one of the issues that we me and Juwan is addressing, is to get to the Black Farmers Association and set up a program where it's going to create the jobs for our brothers and sisters. Because when you begin to start looking at Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution, and they specifically state there that no person held to labor, service or labor in one state under the laws thereof is given into another. When I just read something like that, I say, you know what? We have to, as a people, remove ourselves from that equation, because that clause there and that article was specifically talking about us as a people, but we can remove ourselves from those conditions. These laws that were legislated to keep us down, we can remove our status and conditions from these laws where these laws wouldn't even apply to us. All right, so why? Because we are the people who should be creating the labor for ourselves. We should never run to our enemy for labor. All right, and that's one of our, and if we do, this article would apply. You know, this is something that got to be clear. All right, Brother Tahaka. So peace, Moore.
Big man.
Good one. I like that.
Come on, man. Big man.
Maybe I should go since I'm ready. I was going to say something based on what I heard last on that recording. I noticed, now, I might as well just get it over with quick. I'm going to just quickly poke a hole at the about the word of God that I heard a quick second ago. I just wanted to quickly just debunk the social engineering that took place on the black race and just point out that also not only do I think we need to have our own food, because I think if we could feed ourselves, like the last brother just said, which I 100% agree with, we could stop working at the supermarket and start actually growing some crops in our backyards, you know. But, and also I just want to point out, I noticed how the other brother also said, I forgot his name, sorry, no disrespect, he was saying how he wanted to social engineer us out of the situation we're in. I love that also. That was good. And it made me think in my head how important it is that humanity and that the black man, he utilizes his thoughts and his brain, because apparently we can engineer ourselves the way out. And that just made me realize for a quick second that at the end of the day, it goes to show how godly we are as men, because no disrespect to the theists that are listening, but at the end of the day, although we know, you know, the black race is definitely one of the most prone races to be attracted to the idea of deities and religion. I think that it's also, at the same time, if we're going to re-social engineer ourselves out of the situation, we should also take a kind of glance at how we look to outside forces to change our situation, when apparently we need each other to start growing crops and stuff. So I just wanted to just put that out there. Not to say that I'm trying to convert blacks to atheism, but I'm definitely trying to get blacks to be more open-minded to just respecting both sides of theism and atheism, because I think that if we could close that boundary between black theists and black atheists, that would also be a big step up for us.
Okay, next man.
Brother Lewis Bay, young brother that just spoke.
Yes.
When we put the systems in place, of course we expect the individualism to surface because we'll all be working under the various systems. You know, if you look around you, everything is a system. And as we create different mindsets of values, you know, not just a few things from a collective perspective, and all of us will be able to eat and provide all of the various things that we need here on Earth. We'll discuss in detail at the conference.
Okay, fellas, y'all, hold up for one second. Hold up for one second. Let me open up another line. Area code 773. Please control your background noise. Make sure it's absolutely quiet. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment. Come on in.
Okay, I got a comment. Islam.
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 Islam. Okay. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and my name is Terrence Grovesdale.
Okay, brother.
I'm your brother, man, and friend, and I got a comment.
Come on.
I just wonder, man, why is it so hard for the brothers and sisters to follow the prophet and guide others to follow the prophet?
What prophet
I mean,
are you talking about, brother?
I'm talking about the prophet Nobu Ali, the prophet, Allah.
Oh, man. Because if we do that, then we're not respecting each other's personal opinions, and we can never come together, brother. That's why. If you believe in that, you got to believe in that and be the best example so people follow your example. You can't expect us to follow you.
Nah,
if you follow
I'm
yourself,
not the,
we'll follow you.
I'm not the best example. I wouldn't claim to be. You know, Allah has sent us the best example in the Prophet Nobu Ali, and he sent us the recipe to reconcile the ills and sorrows for ourselves. But we have to
That's
come
true.
Into the embracing of that thought. We can't renegade our way into our salvation.
All right,
the
can I say something real quick?
Yeah, go ahead, bro.
When you say renegade, see, that's the part to me. That's like, I feel like you totally self-degraded yourself. I feel like that was a lack of confidence, because why is it that when we think for ourselves, we're being rebels? When I sit here and tell you I don't believe that I need this stuff, I'm not rebelling. I'm just being honest. See what I'm saying? I think that, I mean, the religions are kind of overrated personally.
That's rather unfortunate. But
not really, because I can help you guys out, because I'm willing to do what I got to do at the time. I don't need justification from a religion to help the black race. So I personally find it as weakness, personally. No offense.
Okay. Hold on. Fellas, this is not a debate, and this ain't about religion. What we're dealing with this evening is Moorish consolidation of power inside the United States. We're dealing with some economics. Y'all hold on for 1 second.
The black people became obsolete in 1966 in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. The new policy was this. Three things that whites came up with. One, that no white person in any responsible position will take any responsibility for what's happened to black folk in the past. Two, nobody's going to feel any guilt for what's happened to black folk. And three, that nobody will approve any programs, public policy that will shift the resources from whites to blacks. That's why they're anti-affirmative action, anti-preference treatment, anti-set-aside, anything else. They're not going to let the wealth shift into the hands of blacks under any circumstance. And so because at that point in time, not only had you become obsolete, but they had you nailed to the wall. And so in the Civil Rights Movement, we had made three fatal mistakes by then, and we never knew it. I was the only black in politics in Florida in the governor's office in 1970. Here's a mistake that occurred. One, is throughout the Civil Rights Movement, black people never had a plan. Never had a plan in all those years. All they said to do was they ran from one Civil Rights Movement and one demonstration and ride to the next. To this very day, blacks don't have a plan. And whites have had plans on us since 1638. You don't have a national plan. No black in America knows where he's going and how he's going to get there, what he's supposed to do. Can you imagine 36 million people with no idea what they're going to do? The second mistake we had made is that somehow they thought by taking down the signs over the bathrooms, on the water fountains, by where blacks could sit, somehow you were dealing with racism. They thought racism was the stuff I'm keep telling you about. They thought the slogans were racism. That was not racism. Racism was four floors down. They never touched racism during the civil rights movement. Allowing a black person to sit on a bus is immaterial. Allowing a black to go into a hotel is a waste of time. Can't he pay to get out? And the third thing mistake we made was that we never created an institution that would educate our young black kids. On how to deal with racism, that we can give them a plan and they would be trained as a leadership class to pick up that plan and run with it. So between 1966 and 1996, black youth fell through the cracks because we let them down. We let them down for a number of reasons. One, because we pursued integration when we should have been pursuing desegregation. Now, what does that mean by that? Desegregation means just stop the government from using its power and resources to deprive you. And what most blacks thought they were getting was assimilation. Assimilation means they wanted to move in, intermarry with whites, and disappear, just like the Asians and Hispanics can do. Whites never gave you assimilation. They gave you integration. Integration is another something behind the counter. Integration is a weaker form of segregation. Now you're weaker than you ever were. Remember I told you about the strong will win, the weak will suffer, the majority will win? Integration means that you have now been scattered into pieces. You have no power. Power doesn't come from individuals. It comes from the group. You all should never do anything as individuals. Do it as a group. Okay? In this church, you all stick together all times. Stick together as a group and stay behind your leader. And they can't get to you. Integration also took away your leadership. The minute you integrated, what you did, you accepted Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole as your leaders. That's why black leadership disappeared. When you integrate, that means you become a guest. Integration means black people become G-U-E-S-T-S, your guest. You're a guest in everything everybody else owns and controls. You're a guest in their hotels, their restaurants, their airlines, their neighborhoods, their schools. You don't own anything in America because you volunteered to become guests. And before integration, blacks had their own communities. They had their own resources. They had their own businesses all over this country. And you young people here today, you don't know it, but I'm telling you, black folk had viable competitive communities before integration. They had clean communities. We did not have the crime in the black communities. As a matter of fact, before integration, most blacks in America never had to lock their doors. And a part of the problem is we don't lock because we didn't have locks on the doors. You got scared to put a chair under the door. And you left your window up all the time because you didn't have air conditioning. And most blacks in the South, where I grew up, when the mother would leave home, she'd say, "Miss Jones, I'm going downtown, watch the house." And I could walk, as a child, I could walk through almost every house in my neighborhood, through the front door and the back door, because open, nobody cares. Or I could go into a house and borrow some sugar and go home, nobody cares. And everybody knew each other. But what they did with integration, they took the Highway Act and said, if you all want to immigrate, you're going to come here without any power and resources. So they took the Expressway of 1952 Act, and they drove an expressway through every black community in America. And so now any city I go to, I can find a black neighborhood by finding the expressway. Either the black neighborhood will be up over it, underneath it, or beside it. And now you have no black businesses. And in North Carolina, where I grew up, my family was the only family that had a part ownership in the only black bus line in the entire United States. We didn't have a bus line with three or four buses. We had the biggest bus line in the state and the only one in America for blacks. We had over 500 buses. We serviced the black neighborhoods and the white neighborhoods. What put us out of business was not Duke Powell, who we put out of business. What put us out of business was integration. Because when Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks integrated the buses down in Montgomery, and black folk wanted to sit on the front of the bus. When it got to North Carolina, the people in North Carolina, the blacks said, "We want to sit on the front of the white buses too." And we said, "But we don't have any white buses up here." They said, "Well, get some so we can sit on the front of them." And so we went out of business. We had black cab companies. We had two black cab companies, the Harris and Camel City cab companies. They went out of business. You know why? Blacks didn't want to ride in the black cabs anymore. They want to ride in the white cabs. They wanted to ride in the yellow cab and the bluebird cab. We had our own theaters. We had the Lafayette and Lincoln Theater chain all over America. We had film companies in Jacksonville, Florida. Norman Productions in Jacksonville made black westerns and black love romance films. We had a black studio in Chicago and a black studio here in Hollywood called Hollywood Productions. It was black owned. We made our own films. Now we have no studios, no distribution system, and no theaters. And what I'm telling you all is you're going backwards. We had mattress factories, we had broom factories, we had blacks in the oil drilling companies. We had a black railroad line in Jacksonville, Florida. We had another black railroad company in Oklahoma. And now we have nothing in the entire United States because integration took it away from us. The other thing the integration does for you, you got to understand, integration also is draining your capital. All your money now is moving out of your community into the white community. Okay? Black America right now is the ninth richest nation on earth. We got approximately $380 billion worth of disposable income. We're richer than Sweden, Australia, Canada, Pakistan, India, and all the black African countries put together. But we're the poorest nation on earth because we violate every principle of economics. Your money is supposed to stay inside your community and bounce 8 to 12 times before it leaves.
Okay, Brother Diallo, come on in. Diallo. Community U Bay. Come on in.
Yes, I'm here. No, what's fine? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you good, man.
Yes, good, Will. Again, Brother Sahak, I got to commend you for clearing that up. This is not a debate. This is about putting food and economics in the mouths and hands of ourselves and our children's future. So I commend you for that, brother, because I don't got no time for no debates and no arguments, especially when I got to feed myself and my baby.
Of course.
And my loved ones around me, like you, Brother Sahak. So I'm here just to feed us, not to get into no fight. But in the meantime, Professor Anderson, he put it out there, hardcore. And that piece is a piece, brother, that needs to be played every single day in the ears of our people. Because if you're talking about social engineering, that's what we need. We need social engineering to hear something like that so we can wake us up, right? But, again, he may mention something about a national plan. I don't know when he wrote that book. I didn't get a chance to read the book. I've seen the book, all right? But one thing I can say that there was a national plan, all right, and unfortunately that plan was overthrown. Well, who brought the national plan on the scene was Nobuju Ali, all right? He brought the national plan. He brought the economics. When I went up to the Schomburg archives in Harlem, New York, right, I did some research in a newspaper called the Morris Guide. Nobuju Ali was bringing in between 15,000 to 18,000 a month, Brother Sahak. I've read
okay.
that. All right. And he had manufacturers and businesses up and running. All right. This is what he had. All right. So that was going on back in the early 1900s with Nobuju Ali and also, of course, Marcus Garvey.
That's a powerful individual right there.
Excuse me?
That's a powerful individual. Individualism.
Yes, exactly. So we had that going on. Those are the two brothers I know. And, of course, Elijah Muhammad, you know, fell right in the middle between those brothers, all right, which is, we know as the Nation of Islam. But the two most powerful brothers at that time was Nobuju Ali, which people do not hear about. And, of course, and when they do hear about him, unfortunately, they just hear about a religious overtone. But the prophet brought two sides. He brought the religious side for those who was religious struck to try to bring him out. And then he also brought the civic side, all right, because he understood what it meant. He said, Prophet Nobuju Ali was the one that said, you take finance to lift the nation. And because of him saying that, I took it upon myself to study finance, all right. And I don't hear no Moors talking about finance the way they should be talking about it. Right, because if we're talking about finance and economic infrastructures that we need to be put into place, we can have our own bailout. We don't need Barack Obama's bailout. All right, and this fiscal cliff that's going on, which is all a fraud. All right?
Right.
So that's
right.
why I was reading Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution about services and labor. All right? Who are they referring to? That's that social engineering that Brother Clark was talking about. All right? These Europeans have created social engineering by using the term Negro, Black, and Colored. All right? Unfortunately,
yes,
Brother Clark do not realize that the social engineering was based upon terms that Europeans have used to label us. We are not Black people, we are not colored people, and we're not Negroes. All
yes,
right?
Sir.
We are more. All right? This is who we are as a people. All right? When we begin to start going back to grade school, Brother Tahaka, all right, and everybody's been to grade school, or if you haven't been there, if you heard about it, about Christopher Columbus discovering America, and the Europeans is constantly keep putting that in your face about 1492, and that was the time that who they were conquering, they didn't say they were conquering Blacks. They didn't say they was conquering Negroes, and they didn't say they was conquering colors. They said they was conquering who? Moors, the very ship that Columbus was sailing on was ships that was controlled by the Moors, which was called the Nino Brothers. All right? Mm-hmm. So we got to go back into our history. We got to start picking up these books like Ancient Martin Brittner by David McRitchie. We got to look at the book called The Story of the Moors and Spain and the Story of the Moors After Spain by Stanley Lane Poole, and we can read and see where all this stuff stemmed from, all right? And it was Noble Du Ali who had the national plan to bring us back into our national constitutional fold, all right, because that was his plan. He didn't just talk about economics. He was talking about a national standard, all right? And I think that's very important because he was socially engineering us back to who we were as a people. So one of the problems that we have in it's because of this Negro, Black, and Colored, all right? There was a time that I heard from Morris, who was way older than me, about 30 or 40 years older than me, had said there was a time that when you call a brother back in his time, in the 50s, 40s, and 50s, a Black man, Black, that was fighting words. So those are fighting words.
Mm.
So how come all of a sudden the word Black, which was fighting words back at that time, become terms of endearment? How come the term Negro is a term that becomes a term of endearment? How come the word colored are terms of endearment? We not paying attention. The French were the first ones who had put the Jim Crow laws on us, going back to Napoleon's Black Code called Code Noir. You understand? That's what he was He called the word Noir, N-O-I-R, is the French word for Black, all right? And so the Black Codes wound up becoming, the Code Noir became Black Codes, and Black Codes we know to get today is Jim Crow, all right? So that's the social engineering. The European was the one who came together with the social engineering terms and called us Negro, Black, and Colored. All right, and then we took upon these undesirable names as terms of endearment, and we thinking that this is a national origin. We need nothing but descriptive terms that allude to slavery, Brother Parker. Please.
Okay. Y'all hold on, fellas. I got three more lines here that I'm going to open up, and I'm going to ask all three lines. I'm going to open it up one by one. Make sure there's absolutely no background noise going on. Please tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment, and please be brief. Area code 314. 314, come on in. Okay, we had a call drop on 314. Area code 386, come on in.
Hello, brother. This is Brother KLB.
Come on, man.
Can you
hear
me? Okay. All right. I'm from Clinton City, Florida. Brother QLB. I want to commend you, brother.
Whoa. Ladies and gentlemen, this brother and his entourage come by my house today, and we sit down and we got some information straight. Now they come up from Clinton City, Florida. And, brother, I hope we made some headway today, and I want to thank you all for coming back. Go ahead.
All right, brother. Yes, we did. You made a lot of worlds different to us. I want to commend you for that, brother, and your hospitality and everything, and taking the time out to invite us in your home. I want to say to the previous callers, the last two previous callers, the one on the civil rights movement and what it did to us. I'm absolutely agree with the brother. And the brother, the last caller, I absolutely agree with this brother. I mean, the Moors, the brother is enlightening these brothers so much. They enjoy this family so much. And they consider themselves as totally a Moorish family. And we're looking forward to working with the Moorish government, because we do believe with all our heart it's time for us to come out of this colorable endearment that they have put on us and become one nation under God and just be strength in numbers. We know that there's strength in numbers. And for us to provide and do for ourselves, as all the other nations are doing for themselves, feeding ourselves in the economic structure and social structure, we, that fragmented community of ours and society, we have to fix this, brother. There's no time left for us to be laying around and playing around. We're through playing around down here. We're ready to get moving, and we're ready to start doing the work for the Moorish Nation, for our nation, and for our people. And I just want to commend everyone on the show for their input, and I definitely, with all my heart and soul, want to thank you for listening to us and bringing us along as you did, brother. All the brothers, thank you. And they just want to show the appreciation and tell you that we are 100% behind the Moorish government and the Moorish nation with all our heart and soul. And whatsoever we can do, we are there to do it. And down here, we're going to have some, we're starting to put in a group to where we can invite them into the center and just listen at this show, invite them all in to listen at this show, and we can get 300 or 400, just come in and listen at this show every night. And that part about the civil right, we definitely need that on every time we hear the show, so that most of the people we bring in can understand what, but they have no idea what really is happening to them. And this is food, brother, food for the soul, and I just want to get that out to you.
All right. Well, I certainly thank you, and I thank you all for coming down, and I really enjoyed you all, and I do think that we made progress.
Yes, we did.
I'm open up area code 706. 706. Come on in. 706. Okay, I'm going to have to mute that one. Ladies and gentlemen, y'all hold your hat for just a second.
Money does not bounce one time. You know why it doesn't bounce one time? Because you don't have any communities to bounce it in. You're so busy integrating. Where are you going to bounce it? How are you going to pass it through another black hand? So as soon as a black person gets paid, Before it touches another black hand, he runs right to the suburbs and spends it. He spends 95% of his money immediately outside his own community. He keeps 5% to take back into his community. Out of 5% he takes back into his community, he spends 3% of that in non-black-owned hands in his own communities. Look around your neighborhood. Goes into non-black-owned businesses. Only 2% again, only 2% of all the black people in America keep their own money in their own communities. And then out of the 2% they keep, they then take that down to a white bank and put it in the bank, can't even get a loan. And now you're bankrupt. You go bankrupt every 24 hours. This is regular clock. And whites don't take you serious. They know that anybody who goes bankrupt every 24 hours should not be taken seriously. You started raising Cain outside their store. They say, hey, wait a minute. It's 3 o'clock. Wait for those blacks. They'll go bankrupt about another 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
They know you're gonna violate all the rules. So the reason we don't have any black businesses in America is for three reasons. One, we've never had a national plan to start building black businesses in the country. That's why I wrote my book. That's why you got a plan now. Two, is that whites and other groups are boycotting your neighborhoods. They're boycotting you. And three, we're boycotting our own neighborhoods and our own stores. That's why we don't have anything. Now, as long as you live, you will never see a white person get up on a Saturday morning, drive down to a black neighborhood, and get out of his car and go into a black store to buy something made by a black person. If you do, take a picture of it. You have something very valuable one day. All over America, on Friday evening, go to any big city, and you'll see blacks lined up to get into Chinatown to go to China, eat some Chinese food. Have you ever seen Chinese lined up trying to get into a black town? Somebody is not playing with a full deck. You're not playing the game to win. You're just playing. And you got to stop spending your money. So then I go to various cities, and blacks got the nasty habit, when company comes, putting them in their car on a Sunday and taking them out to the white community and say, let me go out and show you some nice white homes. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Let's go out to look at the white malls.
I don't get my
And then they come back home and say, how in the world can white folk afford all those fine homes and big houses? It's easy. It's your money. You see what I'm saying? And y'all think I'm teasing. See, they're living off of two incomes. They live off 100% of their income and 95% of yours. And you're trying to live off of 2%. It is humanly impossible for a race of people to live off of 2% of their income. And in America, you equate human worth based on what you own. And if black folk don't own 2%, that's why white racists say, black folk ain't worth 2 cents. Because we don't own anything, and human worth is equated in this country based on what you own and control. And we violate all the premises of economics. We have yet to learn how to practice group economics. And the last thing about integration is that integration got a quota system, and you need to know this. It's got a quota system. You hear white somebody against quotas? They're wrong. It's got a quota system. Anytime you get more than 5 to 8% of blacks involved in anything, whites are going to put up chain. They're going to stop you. If more than 5 to 8% of blacks move into their community, they're going to put their house up for sale. If more than 5% of the blacks, 8% of blacks go into their schools, they're going to pull their kids out of school. If more than 5 to 8% of the blacks come into their businesses, they're going to move the business out of town, cross town, out of the country. If more than 5 to 8% of the blacks come into their association, they'll resign. They got a quota system. And people say, well, blacks are against affirmative action. No, they're not against affirmative action. They're against affirmative action for you. You see, they're against the set aside. Racism is nothing but preferential treatment for whites. They say they're against preferential treatment. You hear them say they're against set-asides. Jim Crow is nothing but a 100-year set-aside program for whites. So they set aside the best restaurants, the best food, the best schools for whites. They say they're against quotas. You got a quota system, I told you, in the immigration laws. Today, you still are a planned minority. You can't win. So now let me get to some solutions for you very quickly. I have a few more minutes I got left. What we're going to do across this country now is going to call Powernomics. That's a new book coming out called Powernomics, Unleashing Black American Potential. It's a follow-up to the book Black Labor, White Wealth. It'll show you in very specific terms what you got to do to be competitive. The things you got to focus on is in broad categories with specific principles. The first is a community. You cannot do anything unless you have a community. Your community is your social cohesiveness. The only power, the potential that black people have in America is your social, racial cohesiveness. If you don't have that, you have no power. Forget about everything else. That's a fact of life. You got to have a community because the community will give you your businesses. It'll give you your sales opportunities and your markets. Now, how do you develop communities? The first thing you must do is stay out of all cross-purpose issues. Cross-purpose means horizontal issues. Don't get involved in any horizontal issues. Let me explain it to you. I see the puzzlements in your eyes. First, racism is vertical. Remember this. Racism is straight up and down. Racism means I don't care whether you are the lowest income black or the highest, the best educated or the least educated. It doesn't make any difference. You're all in the same tube. Okay? That's what Malcolm X was asking. What is a black man with a PhD? Remember that saying? He answered, well, he's still a Negro. Okay? It means it doesn't make any difference. You're all in it together. That's straight up and down. Horizontal issues are any issue that pertains to everybody. Stay out of it. You're the weakest and poorest, most vulnerable people. Don't get involved in it. Because the only people that can benefit are those people who are directly behind where the horizontal crosses the vertical. Okay? The only people that benefit are where those two points cross. That's too small. You don't have that kind of energy and resources to waste. Now, what's a horizontal issue? Sexism is a horizontal issue. If you get into this various religious issues, that's a horizontal issue. Poverty is a horizontal issue. I keep telling some of my civil rights leaders, stay away from poverty. You cannot eradicate poverty. Poverty is a fix. It's a given. You're always going to have poor people. And people say, well, you're going to have poor Greeks, poor Indians, poor Lithuanians, poor Hungarians. Quit trying to eradicate poverty and try to get as many black folk as you out and leave poverty alone. But they try to eradicate something that can't be eradicated. Culturalism. That's a horizontal issue, and it pertains to everybody. Let me give you about sexism, for instance. I tell black women who always want to get into sex issues, they think that somehow that the issue is sex rather than racism. See, my great-grandmother was not enslaved because she's a woman. She was enslaved because she was black. Okay? And if you're going to get into sexism, I want black women to understand this, to keep your priorities in order. If I say abracadabra right now and sexism disappeared, you still can't go into places because you're black. And to keep it in order, remember what your mother felt. The minute she knew she was pregnant, she knew at that moment she was going to have what? A black child long before she knew the sex. So you keep your priorities straight and say, since my color came before.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen. What we're listening to is Dr. Claude Anderson, and you all can type his name into YouTube, Dr. Claude Anderson. I just typed it into the chat room and type in Dr. Claude Anderson Powernomics, and he has over 15 videos, and you can go all the way down from video one all the way down to the end. This is part one. And we're just trying to get to the crux of the matter because we are approaching the Moorish Summit. We're just a few days away, and I want to bring this thing out and give everybody a chance to become familiar with what's about to go down inside the United States. This is no hold barred situation. We ain't playing. I'm certainly not playing. And I want to ask Brother Sundiata, are you still with us, brother?
Yes, indeed. I'm still here.
Okay, give me some feedback on this, man.
Okay, yes, indeed. Well,
please be brief now, because we have a few minutes now. Come on.
Yeah, I'll be brief for sure. Well, one of the things that I wanted to just touch on briefly was the plight that farmers, especially farmers of African descent in this country, have experienced, and it's something that Claude Anderson alluded to in about two clips ago that you played. The federal subsidy programs back in the early 1900s really, you know, hit the so-called black farmer really hard when the federal government really wanted to push certain crops like corn and soybeans and things like that, that they paid those farmers subsidies to produce just those crops. And then when those subsidies ran out and when the government began to move away from subsidizing those so-called black farmers and shifting their monies towards other farmers, then the so-called black farmer was left out in the cold. So you've had this failure to recover by the majority of black farmers here in this country. And even to this very day, you have a you know, every couple of years, the federal government puts out a farm bill. The farm bill in 2013 is going to hurt the black farmer even more, because not only does he have to compete with other so-called minority farmers across the country, but now they're going to have to compete with veterans. They're adding veterans into that pool of individuals that can apply for certain dollars, and it's going to create a situation where less money, they're cutting the budget and funds back on those monies that are available to that pool anyway, and then to add another competitive group or another competitor into it is only going to hurt the black farmer even more. So you got things like that that's going on that will continue to hurt the ability of us to feed ourselves. And I understand all of the back and forth on following the prophet and what the prophet laid out for us. And the prophet did lay out a plan for us. And I like what the brother said in terms of, you know, realizing and recognizing that Prophet Noble Drew Ali brought in finance. He was bringing in buku money on a monthly basis. And we can go back and follow. What we need somebody that's going to lay out what he did and how he did it, not just give rhetoric about, well, just follow the prophet and everything will be okay, because that don't work. That hasn't worked
okay
for a lot of brothers and sisters who feel like they are following the prophet, but their situation may not be changing. So we need
okay
somebody to really lay out what the prophet did specifically when it comes to economic generational wealth. Okay, and then one other thing, Brother Tarka, before I stop, is some of the remedies that we can begin to participate in immediately are CSAs. These are community-supported agriculture. This is when people pool their money together to get a share of produce and a share of the pot every week or biweekly or every month when foods are readily available. So
okay
these are ways in which
we're going to get to that. But just and you're absolutely correct. I have to agree 100%. Just hold on 1 second. Let me run through this next thing right here.
All right.
I'm going to keep it in that order. You always say black first. So stay out of cross preposition. I'll explain all the next time I come back out here on a Powernomics workshop or something. But that's very important. I can show you all the problems you got with that. And see, but once you stay out of those horizontal issues, like I tell some of my Muslim friends, I said, don't be worried about pushing Islamic faith. Push your skin color first and stay aligned with your people. And I tell them, the people in the Baptist church, quit worrying about about being a Baptist and worry about being black. And again, I have to give credit to your minister. It seems like he's one of the few in the country who understands that. That you put who you are and as a people before you start talking about what denomination you belong to. And especially since most of the denominations on the earth all work together to enslave black folk. All of them pimp and hustle black folk. The Catholics, the Protestants, the Baptists, the Jews, and everybody else got black folk. But what we're going to do then is start, once we get past building these communities, then we're going to start getting into what we call practicing building alternative economic structures. That's very important. You got to build your own alternative economic structure. An alternative economic structure, in the short time I haven't got time to explain it, is nothing but building your own city, your own community, your own towns. Building a lot of small sub-communities all over America. You build a community of markets, a community of producers, a community of distributors, a community of retailers, and we all interconnect all over the country and build a vertical order. Let me give you an example, for instance. The reason I'm down in Tuskegee and down in New Orleans is because, as an example, we're trying to build 12 major industries in America. The first one is seafood. Why am I picking seafood? Because one of the first principles of Powernomics is you must always dominate economically wherever you dominate in population. We as black folk are one of the largest consumers of seafood in America. We must dominate in seafood production. So what I did down there was go out there and I got blacks now who are raising seafood on and ponds. They're growing crabs, oysters, clams, catfish, trout, and bass. I'm building 1,000 acres of sea ponds, food ponds, aqua ponds, where they're raising seafoods. Now, I got blacks in the farmers now. They're going to raise grain, wheat, soybean, corn, and wheat. They're going to make the feed for us to feed those fish. Now, when that comes up, I'm heading out here next week. I'm building and putting in $5 million into a processing plant in the South. I don't name the city because I want people to try to cut me off. But we're building our own processing plant. All that seafood then is bought from those black farmers. Those blacks that got land and not using, they're now going into business and making money raising seafood and raising feed. And blacks are now going to be hauling that feed over those ponds. And I'm asking for people to raise the money to build the ponds. We already got about 5 ponds coming up already. And now when it comes up, all that seafood's been picked up and shipped to our plant. And in our plant, as I said, the plant's cost almost $5 million, $4.5 million to $5 million. We already got $30 million of sales already on the books going through the plant, okay? Now, once that seafood comes in that plant, it's processed, diced, sliced, and prepared. And then it's shipped out of there up north. I've identified 12 major cities in the north where I'm building receiverships, distributorships for that seafood to be trucked up to and sold out of there. Detroit, Michigan, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Houston, Oakland, California, and New Orleans. And so people ask me about Los Angeles. Now, when the food gets there, we're going to have a freezer where all that food is stored. And then we're setting up franchises, fast food franchises. That food would then be transferred over to restaurants. Now, we got the prototype restaurants up now in South Dade, 2 restaurants. They are fast food restaurants called Fish Cities. They're selling the fish and all kind of seafoods with a special kind of menu. Now, McDonald's and Burger King, our 2 competitors on both sides of us, do about $780,000 a year. We do twice what McDonald's and Burger King do in sales, okay? Our stores sell $1.5 million. They're doing $1.5 million a year, both stores. And our stores, we got traffic around our stores, 2 blocks long, 24 hours a day around the store. And they're all black owned. So they can't cut us off. I got us locked in from the seafood to the grain all the way to the restaurants in the market. Okay? And the only way they can get me out is to turn my people against us. And they can't turn us against them because I love my folk too much and they think too much of what I'm trying to do for them, so they can't get us out. Okay. And so in those cities, we're selling those franchises to blacks at half what it costs to go into a Burger King store. Burger King store costs you about $550,000 to start a store. Our seafood place costs you about $250,000. And you bring back twice the profit. Okay? So we are beating them in that store. Now, also along the line, we're setting up other kinds of operations. Blacks will be going into the trucking business, servicing that. It's vertically ordered. Some blacks will be selling the restaurant supplies, the security service, the building the stores, the insurance and stuff, the employment agencies. And in each city, our stores will produce something like about 50 businesses per store just in seafoods per city, 50 businesses per city. And any blacks can get these franchises, and you all going to have a chance to get them out here in Los Angeles. We're going to come to Los Angeles someplace like next June. At that point in time, save your money and start raising capital. Now, I'll tell you what we're doing out in New Orleans, so you know now, down in New Orleans, we don't have 1 black tourist area in America. And again, I want my people to come together and build a community. So when I was down in New Orleans, I was going through the black community trying to find the old black community. In New Orleans, right now, when people go there, they got the French Quarters, all white, no blacks down in that area. I've gone over and identified an area now where we're going to rebuild a black community there. And I got 2 blocks of land down there. I'm going to put in black clubs there with black entertainment for a jazz club, a blues club, and a popular club. We're going to put in black restaurants. And we're also going to put in souvenir shops. And we're doing it vertically. And we come out with a national campaign asking all blacks in America, since we don't have a black tourist area in America, plan your conferences only in New Orleans. When you go to New Orleans, I'm asking blacks down there to save your money and help me buy some mini buses. I want about 10 mini buses, except a bus service schedule to go in and out of every hotel to haul those blacks over to that community where they can be entertained and be fed and dined and wined and taken back to the hotel until we build our own hotel in New Orleans. New Orleans has about a 67% black population. They don't own anything in the whole city. And we're going to change that and turn it around. That's what I was in New Orleans for, and we're getting it together real fast. We're getting all kinds of support. Not only all support from blacks, I got a lot of whites all over the country trying to help us, too. They understand the need. So get one thing clear now. All whites are not bad. That's what I'm saying. We got a heck of a problem. Because a lot of them understand, they know that we cannot make it otherwise, so they're helping us. Same thing, let me give you one other example. The third business coming up is leather. I'm trying to get blacks to compete in the leather industry. Now, right now, most of our leather is coming in from Taiwan, Korea, Hong Kong, China. And the reason they're going that way is because they got environmental laws where they can produce the leather cheaper by the labor and also by the environmental restrictions for tanning. I found out how to beat them, so we're going to build a leather industry. I'm trying to get blacks together now. We're going to set up our leather procurement system in Florida. We're going to buy skins, reptile, cow, sheepskin, cow skin. We're going to have a procurement system in Florida. We're trying to build a tannery in Haiti. There's no cheaper labor market in the world in Haiti. We're going to build a tanning plant there where those blacks will have a chance to own that plant along with blacks in America. And while the Asians are shipping their leather to Hong Kong and China to be processed, which will take 60 days, I can ship mine over there in 3 days in Florida and get it tanned and get it back. Okay. When that leather comes back in the United States, I'm trying to set up two plants, one plant in New York and one in Pittsburgh, where blacks will own a plant. It's a cut-and-sew operation. That leather come in there, they can produce at least five different kinds of leathers. Leather for furniture, leather for shoe leather. They're going to produce utilitarian leather, also wear leather, purse bag, and belt leather. Okay? Once that leather's been produced in those cut-and-sew factories, it's going to be sent all over the United States to two major distribution centers, one in the West and one in the North, where blacks like you all can say, I want to be a distributor of that leather. I want to be a warehouser, a wholesaler of that leather. Any of it. Then we're going to put retail shops in the malls in each city and in all these communities where you can sell black-owned leather. Then I'm asking the black entertainers, athletes in America, it's quick going on TV advertising Japanese and Asian leather, advertise good black leather. And so we're going to build a leather industry where you have your own chances, your own industry, and own your own businesses. And as I said, we're going to sink our roots into the ground and grow tall and strong, and nobody can pull us up. And we're going to have our own communities built around our own industry. And each and every one of you have a chance to go in your own businesses where you'll be dependent upon the black above you and the black beneath you to depend on them. Okay? Buy from your own people, trust and love your own people, because nobody else cares about you or have any incentive or interest in black folk in America anymore. And the last one I'm going to give a point is Detroit, Michigan. Going into Detroit, Michigan, is 84% black. Now, I go into the city, they got a black mayor, a black city council, a black board of education, and a black school superintendent, and a black police chief. They said, Dr. Anderson said, since you're here, we're going to give you a trophy and a plaque. Say something nice to us. I said, first of all, before I say something nice, what are you doing for black folk in the city? They said, we got an office of minority business. I said, you got an office of minority business? They said, yeah, that's the first office you should have closed down. You got an 84% black city. You got an office of a minority business for black folk? They said, yes. I said, somebody is not, the light's on, but nobody's home. The first thing you must learn is when you become the majority, you must act like the majority. You see what I'm saying? In Detroit, Michigan, they just reversed. You got an 84% black city, and a 3% white population. The blacks are acting like they're the minority, and then when they're the majority, and the white minority is acting like they're the majority. So everything downtown is owned by whites. Everything in the city is owned by whites. Blacks own nothing. And because the blacks can't get their mentality straight about learning how to practice and learn how to win. And so I go look at the contracts for services and goods in a city like Detroit. 97% of everything in Detroit for services and goods and contracts go to whites. And the city is 84% black. Because blacks don't understand that they are supposed to be winning. And I told him, I said, first, they said, what would you do? I said, first of all, I would sue all of you. Because that's against the law. Because you see, our good jurist, Clarence Thomas, has already ruled, saying that you cannot bypass a majority to give to a minority. You all got to get tricky. When you become the majority, you practice that. Oh, we're the majority now. You see? When you build these communities, you become the majority. And you start the winning. Because remember, the majority wins, the minority loses. And as long as every time you use the word minority, you say, I'm a loser. It creates a negative mindset. Quit putting that negative mindset in your children's heads. And say, when you become the majority, we're going to win. And so therefore, I said, I'll take all of you to court. And the same thing in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is 77% black. And the white developers just went to court to sue blacks in Washington, D.C., saying that they want that the 20% set aside for minorities in the water system there is unfair for to be giving minorities anything. And I agree. I said, you're right. I said, because the whites are the minority. And would you all believe that blacks are fighting to preserve a minority program in a city where they are the majority? Because they can't switch gears. And so what's happening in this country now is now people have become paralyzed. They're just like a deer standing on the highway at night in the bright headlights of an oncoming truck. They can't figure out what they're paralyzed, standing there frozen and getting run over. So what's frozen them is this whole concept of a colorblind society. You do not live in a colorblind society. What that whole concept means is let's pretend that we're colorblind and don't see black folks. Now, that concept came out of one of the think tanks again. And the think tanks kind of came up with a solution to say, how do we maintain this inequity where whites are 50-foot giants and blacks are 1-foot midgets? They say, pretend that everything that black folk want, that you've already given it to them. They say they want freedom. Say, abracadabra, you got it. See, they're not empowering you. They're just giving you symbols and slogans rather than the tools. You want to be equal? Abracadabra, you equal. You want equal opportunity? Abracadabra, you all got it. And so now all the conservative elements of this country have figured out if they go back and take the language of the civil rights movement and use it against black folk can't move. Because black folk can't figure out what to do like that deer on the highway. If forward discrimination took them too far into the garage, the only way you can get the car out of the garage is put it in reverse. They said, no, y'all can't put it in reverse. That's reverse discrimination. We admit that we use forward discrimination to get it in there, but y'all can't use reverse discrimination to get it out. You see? So therefore, you got to keep the car in neutral. And we got to have a race-neutral society now. And that way, however things exist now, it is stuck and frozen like that. And let's pretend we're a colorblind society. And so consequently, nobody wants to look after my people anymore. They just stand there frozen on the highway. And I'm very much concerned. I got all kind of plans on the power numbers, how we can solve some of these problems. Same thing in politics. In politics, start teaching your people to be responsible. And don't vote for anybody who runs in office, green, yellow, black, if he would not deliver back to the black community. Okay? Politics is a process that simply defines who's going to get what out of life. But it must be based on quid pro quo. Everybody you put in the office must deliver something very specifically back to the black community. Don't let them get off the hook by saying, well, I'll hire a black person. I don't care. Clinton will give you that same tale. I'm going to hire a black. I don't care who he puts as a secretary. That's not the issue. What is the black community going to get back in return for its vote? And that's why they keep sucking when you don't ever get anything. Because we don't raise Cain. It must be quid pro quo, something for something. If we give you something, you owe us something back to the race. And that's why the last election, I was Clinton's political advisor in Maryland. And the white vote, 42% of the Hispanic vote and 43.4% of the female vote. But 92% of the black vote ain't done anything for blacks yet. Because nobody wants to do anything for us because we don't demand and insist on it. And you must hold everybody accountable. If a black person runs for office, you go after him and take him out of office too. Any way you can, okay? I know my time is up. I've been watching my clock. My time is just about up, but I would spend a lot of time teaching you how to play politics. There are a lot of rules in polynomics. But the thing I'm telling you in conclusion is everything you do, play it to win. Practice group economics, group politics, build alternative economic structures, redesign your school system. Right now, people are saying school systems are failing blacks. The school systems are not failing blacks. The school systems are doing exactly what they were originally designed to do. That was to produce you, to produce blacks who were marginally educated to work for whites. But now, as I told you, is that blacks are obsolete. They don't need your kids anymore. They don't need half-educated kids anymore. And so what you should do is go back and close down the assembly line and get your plan and say, we will now rebuild our schools across black America based on the needs of black Americans. In other words, what I'm saying to you is this. If I told you all right now we were going to the moon and we agreed to go to the moon, now our schools will know what to do. Because now they say if black folk going to the moon, you see, you got some direction. And now the school system say, well, now we got to produce more mechanics and more astronauts and more physicists and biochemists. We got to prepare for that. But right now the school system is still operating the way they were designed in 1867, with the produced black folk who were marginally educated people. And nobody wants our kids. Our kids keep telling you all that. That's why right now in the large cities, 65% of all the black kids that start nursery school never graduate from high school. They're telling you something, you're not listening. They're saying you're dysfunctional. There's no reason going to school. The school doesn't mean anything. There are no businesses in my community. There's no health. There's nothing in my neighborhood worth staying into. Go back and develop a national plan about where your people want to go, and then transmit that plan to every black individual, every black corporation, every black association. And then we can do it. We got the expertise. We got the skills. We got a little bit of money. And the last thing I do is get rid of a lot of our black leadership. Okay? All these black leaders in America now, the head of our two or three major institutions, keep talking about looking out for everybody but black folk. You tell them that day is over. Nobody's going to sell black folk anymore. The day of selling black folk over. If you want to sell them, you better find yourself another job. Because right now, black folk are hurting too much, and it's too bad for us in this world to keep letting black folk get up there and get in these high positions and talk about everybody but black folk. If you don't want to be black, go home and sit down and look at TV. And I tell all my friends, even those who look up the rainbow, talking about a rainbow coalition, I'm telling you, there is no blackness in the rainbow. And if you want a rainbow, look inside my race and you'll find it. Look at this beautiful rainbow of people, all the colors you want. There's my rainbow. And I love you all and thank you very much.
Okay, Moses, we only have 12 minutes left. So I want y'all to come on in and let me know. Because, see, we on the 12th and 13th of this month, we're finna do this thing. Brother, commit to you, Bay. Come on in, man. Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you, though. I've always been with you, family. You know me. I've been listening very intensively. Of course, Claude Addison, I'm going to check out you. YouTube piece out that you suggest for people to do, Brother Tahak. I really appreciate you. I hope that Jesse Jackson was listening to that when he said there's no black in the rainbow. You know what I'm saying? Because he was the one who was pushing that rainbow coalition. So I know exactly what the brother was saying. All right. Mm-hmm. And also the civil rights movement, he was a part of that also. And it's just interesting because when you go to page 240 of the 7th edition of the Black Thought Dictionary, it talks about civil rights. And it talks about the individual rights of personal liberty guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, all right? And so the only people who really had civil rights were states, all right? And, of course, that was in 1866. So they fabricated that just to pull the so-called black man, woman, and child into that arena, which was legislated, all right? But they didn't have states' rights. So we need to check into that. But I know I have to make it brief because we only got 12 minutes, but about to hock up. I'm going to show my support for this weekend that's coming up for the Morris Summit. Peace.
Okay. Next man, come on in.
Hey, Saharka, this is Brother Sundiata.
Come on, man. Let me have it.
Hey, I just wanted to mention also that one thing that we got to be conscious of, and something that Dr. Carl Anderson kept reiterating, is the circulation of our dollar, that we have to be able to pass it from one Moorish business or so-called black business to another at least 3, 4, or 5 times before it leaves the hands of our people, before it leaves the community. If it does not, if we do not figure out a way and learn how to pass on that dollar or whatever the medium of exchange is onto another black man or black woman's business, then the wealth will continue to leave and we won't be able to create and grow our communities the way that we need to and the way that Claude Anderson is talking about. And what that's creating is a dire economic situation that has our young people ending up realizing that there's not a whole lot to look forward to and not a whole lot to look up to, and it creates this situation where our children end up being categorized and put in certain situations as far as their education. And they don't do well on these standardized exams. And before you know it, I know in the state of Florida, we got the FCAT exam. I know some of y'all have heard of it. You're from Florida, you have the FCAT. And what these companies and private industries begin to do is look to see which child is going to be successful and which child is not, based on their standardized test score from the third grade. They began to map out that child's future from the third grade, and they begin to label that child. So we end up having this pipeline from school to prison. And we see that that is already in full effect, and it has been for the past couple of decades in this country. So in order for our children to be immune to that type of pipeline, that type of situation, we have to create that economic climate for our children. Thank you.
We get back with your brother. Once we get this money, boy, okay. You shut
me Diallo, where you at? Brother Diallo.
I think the brother had to attend another call or have some business to take care of, Brother Tarka.
Okay. All right. Well, let me briefly put this in down. I just come out of Key West, Florida, and this is what I seen. I was down so cold, close to the end of the world, that if I spit, I would be off the earth, 40 miles from the coast of Cuba. I was I went into several areas, and I noticed one consistent thing. Upon passing by these areas, there was always a building or a billboard sign that clearly indicates to anybody coming by that this particular area that you're about to go in belongs to a specific group, a nation of people. All the street signs, the billboard, all the businesses, everything in it belongs to them. If you came from someplace else and you went into this community, the language, the customs, everything that went along that community, you have to go along with it. Otherwise, you don't have no business in it. Now, it was incredible. I went into a Haitian community. Inside this Haitian community, there was one restaurant there, sit right on the corner. There was another area that dealt with hands and crafts. Now, keep in mind that all these businesses inside these communities were one of a kind. If there was a barbershop, there's only one. If there was a beauty salon for women to do the hair, there was only one. If there was a area where you deal with greeting cards, there was only one. If you had to go in there and buy fishing poles and fishing tackle equipment, there is only one. It was one of the most amazing things that I ever seen, because coming from where I come from, it was a total contrast. All of the plant life, all of the trees, even hedges, was totally different. There's no such thing as a pine tree there, period. There are absolutely no fish markets there because the fishing is so abundant. I saw the same type of scenario all over the entire area down there. It was one of the most amazing things, and what these people are doing is they are marking their territory, they are controlling their markets, and they are making sure that all of their money stays inside of their community. They have total control. They're able to say, okay, you want us to vote for you. What are you going to give us? This is what we're bringing to the table. We got 75 businesses, 75 patrons, and between all of us, we got over $300 million in the bank. What are you going to do for us? And then we'll, if it's right, then I'll call one person, and they'll go out and tell everybody else to come down and vote for you. You put you in office, but now you get in office. If you don't do what you say you're gonna do, you don't have a problem. So therefore, this thing here does exist. I've seen it close up and personal. I was inside communities. When I was there, ladies and gentlemen, I'm gonna go into this in part two of the broadcast because the time is fleeting. But our brothers, I certainly appreciate y'all coming on. We're gonna do a part two of this. I'm going to post the information for part two, and so we can do this thing. But right now, I'm gonna have to close this thing down, and I hope we accomplish a lot this evening. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and till next time, y'all be cool.
Wonder why would I be without you in my life? Everything was just a bore. All the things I did, seems I've done them before. But you brighten up.